Roger Bobo has had a huge influence not only as a player, but as a teacher as well, teaching at major universities around the world. So it was fun and interesting to hear him talk about the different types of students in countries in which he taught. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review or rating. Well, in addition to your playing, and I'm going to get to the solo stuff in just a bit, but you also have done a huge amount of teaching around the world. So when you were in Los Angeles, actually, you didn't have a job teaching there, did you, at a school?
For a very short period of time, I taught at USC.
Oh, okay.
And I also taught at California Institute of the Arts. And I wasn't comfortable at either one of them, so I quit. But in USC, right after Marsteller got sick, I was actually teaching trombone at USC too.
Uh-huh, okay.
For a couple of years. And, you know, I had the Eastman School of Music as my reference point for a school. And neither of those schools seemed like Eastman. And I was making enough money in the Philharmonic, and at least I thought I was. And I was not comfortable, so I quit those jobs.
You know, it seems to me that in terms of trombone, at least during that time, the two big teachers were Marsteller, who was on the West Coast at USC, and then Remington, who I think he was at Eastman, wasn't he?
Yes, sure.
And those must have been, were they contrasting styles or just the fact that one was East Coast, one was West Coast?
No, the styles were not parallel. Remington was a basics teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody spent 4 years in school studying with him. They came out being able to play trombone. Marsteller was, he knew everything about trombone function and tuba function for that matter, but he was way into the musicality of things. Remington didn't go there that often. Marsteller seemed to take care of technical things and certainly gave me direction. Most of his lessons were concerned with how to play something, how that would be stylistic.
In addition then to teaching sort of in Los Angeles, tell me if I have these correct in the order. You taught first in the Fiesole Scuola di Musica?
That's in Florence, Italy.
Right. And then Lausanne Conservatory in Switzerland and the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester.
Yeah.
Is it the Musashimo School of Music in Japan?
Well, that was later.
Okay.
I worked at the Scuola di Musica in Florence. I worked at the Lausanne Conservatory, and I worked in the Rotterdam's Conservatory. I worked in the Bern Conservatory, and I'm forgetting one. There's one more.
Manchester School of Music?
Royal
Northern College of Music.
Royal Northern College of Music.
What was different between those schools? I mean, was the style of playing radically different? And I would think the mentality of teaching in Italy would be really different than teaching in Japan, for example, and just the lifestyle.
You know, I mean, the Italians in crisis, they say, oh, mamma mia, let's go have a glass of wine.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see that happening in Japan.
No, but they would go and drink sake.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they were serious drinkers, but it wasn't prime. I mean, I was using just as symbolism. You know, the Italians, we have a party. You know, everything's okay. The Japanese are very, very serious. And it takes a long time to get them to loosen up. And you can forget humor because the language prevents that.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, and metaphor doesn't exist. And then Tom used a great phrase one time when he was talking about the Japanese. He says, "And this place right here, I want you to play that a little faster and step on it." You know, step on it? What are they talking
about? Yeah, yeah, uh-huh.
And it was a problem. I was in Japan for 10 years, and I enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
It's a great country.
I had my frustrations teaching, but everything else about the country was just extraordinary.
You know, one thing that I noticed about Japan, I've been there a number of times, and tell me if this is true. when I taught trumpet there, I did a lot of private teaching where, you know, where I'd give an hour lesson to different students. And I would say probably 80% of the students that I taught were female. And I kept noticing this more and more. And finally, I started asking, why are so many of the players women? And they played really well, too, quite a few of them. And what I was told was that when the children are at a certain age, they have to choose between sports and music. And the boys get the first choice. And because they get the first choice, they choose sports instead of music. And so the girls have to go into music. Is that true? Or is that just some sort of crazy rumor?
I don't know that. It could be true. Because I'm sure there are certain things that went by me that I didn't know about. But you said 80%. I did a study on that. And twice a year, we would have examinations for all the brass players in the school. And it was about exactly 80% women.
Even low brass?
Even low brass. Tuba, I counted it one time, maybe it was 60%. And they could play.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the question came up, what are these girls going to do when they finish? Especially euphonium. You know, it's my joke that 75% of all the girls in Japan, 75% of them were euphonium players.
Okay.
And I still have that impression. 80% were horn players. You can see that starting this show in the sections now. Trombone players, maybe 50 or 60%. Tuba players, 50 or 40. Trumpet players, 80. And they study, and then they either get married and become a Japanese wife, or they go back, or they go back to their local schools in the local cities and start teaching there, which causes the standard to raise. So the high standard in Japan is amazing.
It is. It's really good.
You know, I've only been gone 10 years, or no less. I've been gone 6 years, and they are, the bass players are better today than they were.
In Japan, I mean, there are all these really great women players, and it seems like, you know, if they would either get married or do a lot of teaching, but it seems like it's really hard for them to get a job in an orchestra. You sense that there's a sort of bias that way?
Yes, it exists. Not only in music. They don't have equal rights. However, it's changing rapidly, rapidly. And I know that it's not equal rights because I read it and I see it on the news. But when I look at an orchestra, it's not that different from LA.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, and especially brass players. You know, I saw an orchestra the other day. I don't know which orchestra, but it was, I think the horn section was all women.
In Japan?
I think so.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
Yeah. And these exams that we would have twice a year, some of these girls could play so beautifully, especially horn and especially euphonium. I had one girl who played tuba. So incredible. She was wonderful. Trumpet less so for some reason or other. I think there's not too many women with that Tom Stevens mentality that are going to be the quarterback types that play trumpet.
There are not too many men with that Tom Stevens mentality, probably.
Gracias, Dio.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, that was a great mentality, too, just Tom's own mentality.
Well, we got used to it. It was special.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did you have to alter your teaching style when you taught, for example, like in Italy as opposed to Japan?
Yes. I could be a lot more personal in Italy. In Japan, I know they don't get some of the musical things that I try to teach. They want to know what to do to play high, what to do to play low, where to put your tongue. That was hard for me. In Italy, you know, you sing it to them. Can you sing? Yeah, sing this for me. Okay. Mamma mia, why don't you play like that? Mamma mia, what a good idea.
Uh-huh.
And that was an Italian lesson, sort of exaggerated, miniaturized Italian lesson. But most of the students I had were very musical players. Now, I said that the Japanese were a little bit stiff and technically oriented. However, not that I hear today. When I go around and hear Japanese students of today, they're playing beautifully. They're so expressive, and I don't know what happened in 6 years, but it's completely different than it was.
So it's changed that quickly. I wonder if that has to do with women, let's say, getting more rights or having more opportunities.
I'm sure that's part of it, but I think the biggest reason is internet access.
Oh, okay.
Because excellence is available every day, every type of excellence. And I'm sure they listen to some of that stuff. And there's a master class on 3 times a week. There's a big name master class on, and they listen to that. They have these international competitions. I know you're sometimes a judge on those, and they hear what's going on. They hear who wins, and they hear what's necessary. And I think they enjoy playing musically.
It sounds like it's a really smart approach, too. And just speaking about trumpet, so I don't know about the other instruments, but there are a couple of women trumpet soloists now, Alison Balsam and Tina Ting Helsing.
Yeah, sure. Who, I know them. I know about them.
Yeah. And I think just because of those two people, they are real stars. And I think that's been incredibly inspiring for young girls, you know, and then 10 years later, these young girls are mature players who are inspiring other people. And so I think things are changing very quickly. So that's
great.
Many
of them go back to their village and inspire kids.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's turning fast.
It is. I interviewed early on Abby Conant, and our interview was about gender discrimination and what she had to face in Munich. And it seems like the world today is really a different world than it was then. So, well, when you taught at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester, was that sort of the teaching style or the way you would teach? Would that be sort of in between Italy and Japan, would you say?
Well, first of all, let me say that the Royal Northern College of Music was a brass band school. It was the world's brass band school. And people went there to learn how to play in brass band. So I learned a lot. I was the beneficial student. And there were some great players with fingers that I wasn't used to teaching in Italy and even Germany, for example. Again, I taught my way, and I think the British were not quite as inclined to follow the phrasing and the musical ideas I was presenting. But they did, and it was beautiful. They could play. And where else did I teach?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about, or maybe a lot, about Mexico, because that might have been your biggest challenge, but maybe your most satisfying accomplishment as a teacher?
Well, in a way, but I have to clarify that. Most Mexican players don't want to take lessons, because especially from me, because they know, they think they have to pay for it. Most education in Mexico is socialized, so that Mexican kids, for a big part, think that they shouldn't have to pay for lessons. Somebody else is going to pay for it. Plus, there's a language problem. You know, I haven't mastered Spanish, so I have very few Mexican students, but I have a whole new kind of teaching online, where I have French students, Japanese students, you know, all over the place, Italian, Spanish, Canadian, British, Irish, and it's so frustrating not to travel all the time, but the students that I have now are the most interesting I've ever had, because I have to be flexible and go from Ireland to France to Spain to New York City to, you know, Winnipeg.
Yeah, that's great.
It's more challenging. And it also brings out the fact that, you know, you're asking me questions about nationalities, and it's true, it changes from place to place, but nothing changes more than the personality to personalities. You know, these individuals are all different. And even in Japan, the individuals were different. There's an old Japanese saying, the nail that sticks out gets pounded in.
Okay.
And I hated that saying.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody would say that to me once every 6 months. And I didn't like it.
Yeah, I think in America, we tend to like the nails that stick out.
Yes, exactly right. We encourage that.
Yeah, exactly. Elon Musk is sticking way out, for example.
Other things in Japan that I don't want to say annoyed me, but that's the word that pops to mind, is that in America, in my recognition, we have a way of passing our students around to each other freely. Tommy Johnson and I would send students to each other. Harvey Phillips has sent students to me. And so it goes around the country, and we're comfortable with that. That's, at least it was, up until 6 years ago, very awkward in Japan. If you want to share students with somebody, you have to do it clandestinely, which was a problem for me. I had students who came in for a private lesson. They would pay me and please ask me, please don't speak about these lessons. And I had one student, and the money comes in an envelope. And it sounds unreal for today.
No, I know that. Yeah, that's how they do it.
It's an envelope that they drop on the floor, and you pick it up, and they say, oh, it fell down, and it's got money in it. And one kid, I guess it said Maestro Bobo. It was in Japanese. And it fell out and fell onto the floor when he was taking a lesson with his principal teacher in the conservatory. That was bad.
Boy, yeah. So teachers tend to be very territorial there?
Exactly. Really territorial. I was teaching one place. I think it was in Kyoto or Osaka. And I had a lot of tuba players. And there was a trombone teacher there. I can't remember his name. He was a great teacher. I saw him teach. And I thought, man, this is world-class, fine teaching. And he and I hit it off, and we became friends. And I proposed, not to him personally, but to my manager, who knew him personally, that we do a joint master class sometime. And said, oh, no, we don't do that. But he was a fine teacher.
You know, I might have misspoken when I mentioned Mexico, because what I was thinking of was, didn't you conduct a brass ensemble there where the students really knew very little, but they were really eager to learn?
Yes. Let me tell you this whole story.
And I think they were very poor as well.
Really poor. I started off teaching at a brass camp, but it was more than just a brass camp. It was a live-in band camp called SACOM. It was a center for the musical development of indigenous kids, you know, something like that, C-E-C-A-M. They came from the villages up in the mountains, the state of Oaxaca, but maybe a 3 or 4, if the weather's bad, 5 or 6 hour car ride into the mountains. And they lived at this place for 2 or 3 or some 4 years and just did band every day. They were amazing. Most of them spoke Mije and not Spanish. And they were very poor. For example, I had the only room in the whole area, several acres, that had a hot shower. Once a week, I had a lineup, especially of girls, waiting to get into my room to take a hot shower. They would wash their clothes in cold water and hang it up on the line, and then it would rain, and so the clothes might be up there 3 or 4 or 5 days. I started off with this brass ensemble with a Bach chorale. It's a beautiful chorale, and it goes, you know, and you and I, in our background, we would know sort of how to play a Bach chorale. It went like this. dun 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 dun. And it took me 2 weeks to get them to understand what legato was. They just didn't know. And I worked with them. I had 2 months there. It was the most amazing 2 months of my life. And, dealing with non-musical things. I came from Tokyo to this camp outside of this small town called Tlahuitoltepec. There were no toilets here. There were outhouses in a long row, maybe six stalls or five stalls in a row. I had a hard time adjusting, and I enjoyed it so much, but rehearsal would start at 4:30. If they're there by 5:15, I was happy. Well, even here in professional Oaxaca, they're only a half hour late instead of 45.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I came from Japan, where it's on time. And I had an ensemble once where I had Italian students. They'd show up about 20 minutes late. I had French students who would show up about 10 minutes late, German students who would show up 5 minutes beforehand, Japanese students who would show up on time, and American students who would show up on time. It was really hard to organize something and get it together.
Boy, I can imagine.
After my 2 months in Tlahuitoltepec, I met some people and I made connections with the Arts Council of Oaxaca. And I proposed the idea of a Oaxaca brass ensemble. And they went for it. And I got students between 14 and one was 40, so we won't count him. But you students around 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. And there was 15 of them. And we worked out stuff that really sounded good. And we gave concerts in the big concert hall. And it was called OBE, Oaxaca Brass Ensemble. And that was wonderful. I enjoyed that so much. And I was able to get styles going. We played Ralph Sauer's arrangement of The Planets.
That's a hard arrangement. We played that in Summit Brass.
Yeah.
That is not easy.
Well, we played it and it sounded good. Maybe you know the fanfare by Castro.
I think I've heard it. I've never played it, but yeah.
It's brilliant fanfare. We played that. It played it well. And, the next piece on the next concert was to have been Pictures at an Exhibition. You know that arrangement too, I'm sure.
Right.
And then the government. We had 2 years of Oaxaca Brass Ensemble. And I was so proud. And they were sounding wonderful. It wasn't just young students, but they sound great. And they have musicality. It's in their blood. And then the government of Mexico changed. And most of music in Mexico, particularly Oaxaca, was canceled. Even the Oaxaca Symphony was canceled. No more money. So one day we had the Oaxaca Brass Ensemble. And the next day, it was canceled, didn't exist, and we couldn't get it. I couldn't get it back together, and it's very disappointing. So I ended up here, living a wonderful life, working twice a week with the Oaxaca Brass Ensemble, and then that was, I just stopped. There was no decompression time. It was just like, okay, there's no more Oaxaca Brass Ensemble.
Boy.
And I was living in Oaxaca. I didn't have the money from the Oaxaca Brass Ensemble anymore. And I just decided to stay here. I like it a lot. I have a beautiful house that cost me $250 a month.
Really? That's nice.
So I have a really good life here. And I do all these online lessons from all over the world. Of course, I had, I was in Japan last year. At this time, on this date, I was in Japan last year. No, this date, I was back in Oaxaca for 2 days. I came back the 9th, and I was booked to go on a nice tour across America at various universities, and then to Slovenia, Italia, Switzerland, and I can't remember where, and then to Jerusalem. And it was all fixed. I was ready to go. And then coronavirus came. And that was exactly 1 year ago. And I had to cancel that. That was my ideal tour. It was the best tour of my life. Japan, United States, Europe. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
It was also income. But when corona hit, it stopped.
For many people.
And we all talk about it, you know. Probably you. Øystein Bosvik is in the same boat. Stephen Mead is in the same boat. Just stopped. No more touring. That's how it's been. And I've gotten my musical and teaching needs on the internet, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, hopefully once COVID is over, how things will be in the future. If there's going to be, I think there's probably going to be a lot more online teaching than there was before. And I think that's a great opportunity because I remember when I was a student, I was lucky enough to get a lesson with Adolf Herseth and also Bernie Adelstein from the Cleveland Orchestra, but I had to fly to Chicago and to Cleveland. And now if I wanted to take a lesson from a great player, I could just do it online.
Well, it's a different technique online, but I'm not sure it's worse. It's just different.
Yeah.
And there's another aspect that's happened too, is that creative people, from the need to create something, have made projects. And from just a recital to a video to some kind of combination, multimedia thing. And they're... every day there are new things, and some of them are truly awesome, wonderful. And that wasn't there 1 year ago to the degree that it is now. And so I hope when we're back on the road and doing what we normally do, I hope this frequency of excellence that we see online is going to stay. I think it will, because people find, I can do this online. I can't even do that live. So they're going to do it. It makes me feel inadequate because I see these sophisticated videos.
Yeah, I know.
There's 25 people or 100 people. We did something with 100 tubas once. We played Nimrod, by...
Oh, I think I heard that. Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and, that's not so possible. To get to happen in New York City. I've been trying to get 100 tuba players in New York City. Could you come over?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. I mean, there's opportunities that we don't have in non-internet lives. They're going to stay. So I hope to go back on the road. And the first thing I'm going to do, I think, next August, I'm going to be in Taiwan. Now, that's not a sure thing yet. It's iffy. But I hope to be in Taiwan in August. And I wanted to go to Europe this July, but I'm not sure it's going to work out. I doubt it very much.
Those who know Roger Bubble know that he likes to eat good food. So our conversation turns to restaurants and food. Japanese is his favorite. And he tells a few stories about being backstage with personalities such as Pavarotti and Horowitz.